Hotel history is created for adult audiences. Content may not be suitable for all listeners. Discretion is advised. You're listening to Hotel History. We take you with us through the sordid history and scandals of some of the world's most famous and infamous hotels. I'm Dieta.
And I'm Yael. Let's get started. Louisville. How do you say it? Is that the Louisville accent?
Louisville.
I can't. You sound drunk.
Oh, Louisville.
Louisville. Louisville. Why are you laughing at me? Anyway.
So we are bringing you our very first Kentucky Derby episode. And we have chosen the Seelbach Hotel in Louisville. It is one of the premier hotels in the city. Of course, lots and lots of people are going to be staying there this coming weekend for the Kentucky Derby at the famous Churchill Downs. Have you ever watched the Derby?
I have seen bits and pieces. So the first time I was exposed to the Derby was I was in my 20s, and because I'm from New York and no one talks about it. It's not on the local news. And I didn't grow up with cable. So like I was really just narrowed into my little corner of Brooklyn. But my aunt is really into horses. And I remember one time we were at my grandmother's house and we were just like, it was like really a really big year for the Kentucky Derby. And we all were sitting around watching it. And a horse, forgot his name, like Chromium. Does that ring a bell? Like had a name like that one.
I don't know, but that sounds like the name of a Derby horse. So,
and that was the first time. And I was like, oh, okay. I mean, I didn't realize how big it was until that point. I'm like, oh, this is like a really big thing. I mean, horses are so cute. And I don't know if they want to be called cute, but they are. But that was my introduction. Also, is Seabiscuit based on the Kentucky Derby?
Yeah, Seabiscuit was one. Secretariat was another famous one.
Secretariat, okay. Yeah, if I owned a horse, what would you call your horse?
Oh, I don't know. That's such a good question. My fiance and I have a whole list of band names that we just come up with constantly. So I would just pull up that list and probably name it those.
Yeah.
I found a Sports Illustrated article that has some of the best and worst names. In 2017, the winner was named Always Dreaming. Isn't that nice? I love that. Yeah. I remember when American Pharoah won. I was watching that year. Oh, he was the Triple Crown champion. That was a big year in 2015. Empire Maker. That's a good
Empire. Name. Okay. So, yeah, they have to have, like, strong names.
Yeah.
Why not just name your horse Race Winner?
Either way, it's either going to be perfect or it's going to be ironic. So you can't go wrong. Sinister Minister.
Oh, that's so cute.
That's a great one. Vagabond. That was from the year 1875. He placed 14th.
How long has this been going on?
A long time. Let me look. 1875.
Who started this? Oh, I'm so curious.
Let's see, in 1874, Colonel Meriwether Lewis Clark Jr. from the Louisville Jockey Club acquired land for the racetrack from his uncles, John and Henry Churchill. Oh, that makes sense as why it's Churchill Downs.
Oh, damn. Wow.
Yeah. It's the oldest continuously running sports event in the United States.
Really? I would think golf would be.
When did the golf become a thing?
Just assume sticks and balls have been around.
All right, so the Seelbach, it was founded by Bavarian-born immigrant brothers, Louis and Otto Seelbach. So the hotel opened in 1905, and it's designed in the French Renaissance style. I feel like I should know a lot more about hotel architecture by now.
Can I? Yeah, but here's the thing about hotel architecture that we've learned is that sometimes it's made up.
I'm like, this is French Renaissance, but this is neoclassical, and this is,
yeah.
And I'm like, this is revivalist, and I'm like, those all look like buildings with columns.
It looks a little neoclassical in the inside. I think
to me, they just all look the same.
The same.
Yeah. But it did. It was, they brought in like the best of the best. They wanted this to be a luxurious place to stay. So you've got marble from Italy, Germany, and France, wood from the West Indies and Europe. I didn't know that the West Indies was known for wood. I know that now. They brought in Turkish and Persian rugs. Louis and Otto both immigrated from Frankenthal, Germany. Louis came first. He arrived in Louisville at 18 in 1869 when he was 17. They both came here because they wanted to learn about hospitality in the U.S. So he worked in the first Galt House Hotel, which is another really famous Louisville hotel. And when he turned 22, he opened the Seelbach Bar and Grill, which immediately took off. And so that enabled him to bring his brother Otto over to help him. And that's when they decided to open the Seelbach. So they opened the first one, actually, in 1891 above a bar and grill at 6th and Main. But I guess that's not where it ended up staying.
Well, we gotta recognize the first attempts of hotels.
Yes. When I was reading a little bit about the Galt House, I think there's been like three different iterations of the Galt House. So they definitely start and stop and... So they really wanted to build Louisville's first grand hotel. They're wanting that old world grandeur of European hotels like Vienna and Paris. No surprise, since they are from Germany. So they formed the Seelbach Hotel Company and purchased a piece of property at the corner of 4th and Walnut, which is now Muhammad Ali Boulevard. And they broke ground in December 1903. And the hotel opened its doors on May 1st, 1905, just in time for the Kentucky Derby. Very good timing on their part.
What a coincidence. Yeah.
And it's only a couple miles from Churchill Downs. So it was a really good location to be able to host people who were coming into town for that. On opening day, over 25,000 people visited the hotel.
That's a lot of people.
A lot. That's crazy. We thought the Mayflower was intense for having 3,000 people at their opening day gala.
How many people live in Kentucky? Was everyone there?
Well, I'm sure a lot of people were in town for the Derby specifically. So I bet it was a lot of out of towners as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I mean, Louisville is pretty decently sized now, but I don't know how big it was in 1905.
That's what I'm saying. Was it the whole state?
Yeah. Everyone came. So the Seelbach hosted a gala that evening with dinner parties in each of the 150 rooms.
At the time of construction, little else existed in the area around 4th and Walnut Streets. When the Seelbach brothers proposed their project, the mayor of Louisville said, "No one will come to a hotel so far away." Wow, what a hater. Several others attempted to discourage building on a property so far from the center of Louisville. Since then, Louisville has expanded, and the Seelbach Hotel long has been astride one of the city's booming shopping and business districts. Of course, because cute hotel, cute horses, shopping for cute shoes. I mean,
25,000 people come to your hotel on opening day. I think you're a draw.
I mean, yeah, I now want to see a map of Louisville. And watch this. It's like three blocks away from the center. And they're like, no one's going to go there.
So far.
It's too far. No one had cars at the time either. Maybe that's why. Between the 1930s and 1960s, the Seelbach Hotel even anchored an area with Louisville's best shops. Although it fell into disrepair for a period, today the area is again a bustling culture and commercial center. The area surrounding the hotel is filled with other large hotels in competition for the Louisville area guests. Not only has the city grown around the hotel, but more hotel owners were inspired to build in the same area after seeing the Seelbach's success. Well, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, when one person is doing a good job, they're like, I'm going to try that. I want to make, you know, get my stake and make my money. But something that we've seen over and over again, hotels literally create cities. I mean, I remember reading the Chateau Marmont was basically a deserted, empty, non-LA land. Like, it was just not incorporated at all.
Yeah, there was nothing. It was like a dirt road leading to it.
Yeah. So then you get the hotel, you have the guest visitors coming. And so then you need the restaurants and the shops and the entertainment because you want it to be next to the hotel. I mean, like,
Well, especially whenever it's built to be catered to the more well-to-do, because that's, you know, they typically want something a little further out of the way. They want to be away from everybody else. But then everybody's like, well, that's going to be economically stimulating for the rest of us. So everything starts to grow up around it.
Yeah. But wow, what a naysayer that mayor was.
I know. Like, glad they showed him.
I think, but it keeps popping up with like the innovation of hoteliers. They are so risky. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to be, but they're just like, nah, bitch, I'm going to show you. And I'm not going to just make a hotel. Like, this isn't a Motel 6. I'm going to make the hotel.
Yes.
That's going to go down in history. It's going to be one of the best. And it's going to bring so much business to the city. And they should really get rewards.
Yeah, they should get the credit. I mean, they're visionaries.
Yeah.
So given the time period that we're talking, there were two entrances to the hotel, one for gentlemen and one for ladies, of course. Which hotel were we talking about recently that had a second ladies entrance? Oh, the Empire. The Empire in New York had a ladies entrance. This was the time of definite segregation between men and women in hotels, because typically a hotel was really more of a man's place. Men were the ones who were able to travel. They're traveling for business. Women always had to have chaperones. So there was a gentleman's billiard room, a gentleman's poker room. Usually there would be some sort of gentleman's lounge. And then here on the second floor, there were parlors for the ladies to hang out in if the gentlemen were off doing their business.
Tucked away on the second floor in the corner.
Exactly.
You don't get to play games. You just get to sit and talk.
You don't get to go to the bar. No. You don't get to smoke the cigars. You don't get to play the pool. You don't get to play poker. Just sit in there and knit until we're ready for you.
And then everyone goes, why do women gossip so much?
Mm-hmm. Why are women so unhappy all the time? Why can't they just be happy with their lot?
Yeah. Well, maybe this is our sport, bitch, because you didn't give us a sport and we were shoved in a corner to talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Gossiping for women is a sport.
Exhibit A, Hotel History Podcast. So the Sealback has a signature cocktail, which obviously I guess we're going to need to do a video for that, called the Sealback, of course. But this cocktail goes back to 1917. So this is a really old one. The bartender at the time, Max Scoopy Allen, his nickname was Scoopy.
Just saying.
I guess from...
Is he scooping the ice?
Ice?
Yeah.
So the story goes, he was making an old-fashioned in the basement beer garden called the Rothskeller, and somehow, no one knows quite how, champagne got splashed into his mixing glass. Like, did someone bump into
him? No, I think we all know what happened. Yeah. He was drinking a bottle of champagne. He's taking his break in the cellar. And was like, I'm making an old-fashioned here. And they're like, oh, yeah, let me see. And he's like, oh, quick. Shit, I need to get rid of
it. So, some champagne was added to this old-fashioned and the Sealback was born. So the hotel's recipe for it includes Old Forester bourbon, Cointreau, Angostura bitters, Peychaud's bitters, and champagne on top. So during World War I, the hotel turned the Rothskeller into a USO. So let's talk a little bit about what the Rothskeller is. So as we just mentioned, that it was sort of their basement beer garden where the drinks were served.
What is a basement beer garden? Is it
so
is
it's
it like
a
rest,
it's basically yeah, it's basically it's not a speakeasy because it wasn't prohibition yet, but it was basically a bar, but it was on the basement level.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the Rathskeller was a rare and distinctively Seelbach South German influenced restaurant. Because the brothers were from Bavaria, they added this kind of little German flair to their hotel. Today, the Rathskeller is also used as a ballroom, but Rathskeller means council's cellar in German. It's a common name in German-speaking countries that refers to a bar or restaurant located in the basement of a city hall. I love that their government building has a bar in it in German-speaking countries. That
makes sense.
So on brand.
Yeah, it really is. But this, I feel like this does become a speaking. Well, let's not get ahead of it.
Well, it can't be a speakeasy because it's too well known. So they wouldn't have been able to do that during Prohibition because it's too already like everybody knows that there's a bar down there. But the walls are lined with hand painted Rookwood pottery. It's a beautiful building. You have to go online and look at it. It has a vaulted ceiling covered in hand tooled leather. And around all of the columns are these pelican statues sort of embedded into the column because one of the brothers was very superstitious and somebody told him that pelicans are good luck. So all of the pelicans are on all of the columns down there. It's a really cool, it kind of looks like an old church down there because it's columns everywhere leading up into these huge vaulted ceilings.
It is really, okay. Yeah, it is beautiful.
But Rookwood pottery, which the whole place is just covered in, stopped being made in the 50s. So it's really expensive now. And their Rathskeller might be one of the biggest collections of Rookwood pottery in existence now.
Wow. Is it like a special artist that made it?
Yeah, it's like the special handmade pottery that was made in Cincinnati.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
And then the building, I keep saying the building, the room also has this really cute Romeo and Juliet balcony on one side that has original Tiffany glass.
It's so pretty.
Really pretty.
It's really, and Tiffany glass is like, I love the style.
Yes.
The old Tiffany lamps. Yeah, that's rare. I'm shocked. Yeah. They must have to really maintain this room.
So during World War I, as we said, they turned the Rathskeller into a USO for the U.S. Army recruits. So the young soldiers would go there to drink, you know, let off some steam, and that they could also meet up with the young ladies of the area.
One of those recruits was F. Scott Fitzgerald. Of course, he's everywhere.
Everywhere.
Literally. If there's alcohol, he's there. Who frequented the hotel in April 1918. While training for his deployment in World War I, one night after expensive bourbon and cigars, he had to be restrained and was ejected from the hotel.
Very Fitzgerald.
Wow.
He never met a hotel he didn't get thrown out of.
Was there a fountain nearby? In fact, he was thrown out of the Seebach USO three times in 4 weeks. How was he not thrown out of the army at that point?
Seriously, I know, because that's how badly they needed soldiers.
This experience seemingly did not tarnish his memories, as he later included a fictional hotel akin to the Seelbach as the setting for the wedding of Tom and Daisy Buchanan in The Great Gatsby. So this makes sense to me, because he had a great time, because he kept coming back and getting kicked out. I know a lot of people that keep going back to their favorite bars and get kicked out.
Yep.
In this story, it is mentioned that Tom rented out an entire floor of the Mobach Hotel. Okay.
Wow.
Okay.
Really changed that up. We'll never be able to tell.
I guess the other hotel they went to was the Glaza. I think he just mentioned
weird.
The plaza.
Why doesn't he change the name of the plaza? Maybe because it's such a landmark that he's like, no, I got to use the real name.
Or he didn't get kicked out as many times.
Yeah, maybe.
He had more beef with the Seelbach.
He was like, I'll show you. I won't use your name.
Which could either refer to the Grand Ballroom, once located on the roof of the hotel, or the Rathskeller, located in the basement, where Fitzgerald often went to the bar. So in the book, they have this wedding in this made up hotel that's not made up. And you know what? If it's your wedding, you go, you have the wedding on the roof and then you go party down to the basement.
Exactly.
Sounds like a good time.
Yeah.
Man. Okay. I think I definitely would want to party with Fitzgerald. I just want to sit there and be like, what you gonna do?
Just want to see what happens. Yeah. So I bet that it probably refers to the grand ballroom, because I feel like Tommy Buchanan would have rented out the grand ballroom.
Yeah. They're not going to get like the basement bar for their wedding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Fitzgerald is also said to have met George Remus at the Seal Bock. Remus was a Cincinnati mobster referred to as King of the Bootleggers, who got rich running whiskey northward during Prohibition. As a local gangster, he would spend time at the Seal Bock for business and pleasure. He was renowned for lavish parties at the Marble Palace, his Cincinnati mansion. At one, he presented all his female guests new Pontiacs.
What?
At another, he gave each male guest a diamond stick pin. Scantily clad aquatic dancers performed in an in-ground pool, and flowers overflowed as if somebody had delivered a greenhouse. So that sounds quite a bit like Jim Gatsby.
Yes.
So a lot of people have said that Fitzgerald was fascinated by this guy and he was the inspiration for Jay Gatsby. Now, is that true? Maybe, maybe not, because Prohibition didn't actually start until 1920, and Fitzgerald was at the Seal Bock in 1918. So there's no proof that he actually ever met Remus or that they interacted.
Maybe he just read about him.
But yeah, but I'm wondering if maybe he read about him and was like, oh, this is the guy. Yeah.
I just would like to say the women really won on the parties there. They got new Pontiacs, and all the guys got were like some diamond pins.
I really love that, because it feels like a gender swap at the time. Like, obviously, like, normally you would give women jewelry and men cars. So I love that he's like, no, the ladies need some wheels.
Yeah. He's like, run away.
Get as far from them as you can.
Yeah, that sounds like a fun party. Too bad it just sounds like not in a fun place, Cincinnati.
I've never been to Cincinnati. I don't know a lot about it, but I mean, all you need is that mansion. You don't really have to go to the rest of the city.
In 1923, on Derby Day, some gentlemen were playing a game of high-stakes poker in the hotel's poker room. They had a security guard present to make sure no one cheated. Someone knocked on the door and four armed men came in, took all the money off the table, ripped the phone out of the wall, and shoved the security guard in the closet. They then locked the door to the room from the outside and disappeared into the Derby festivities in the street.
Never to be found. They got away with it.
Fuck. How? Wait, what? The security guard did not do anything.
Well, no, he didn't have a gun. He was just there to make sure that the players weren't cheating.
I know, but you would think...
Against four armed men? What's he going to do?
That's true. That's true. But I would also assume these men are armed that are playing high stakes poker, because you just assume they're like gangsters or...
I think they were like wealthy people at the guests of the hotel.
Do they know? So years later, they have no idea who...
No, it was never figured out, because the people just disappeared. It was Derby Day, so there was so many people on the street that they were able to just disappear into the crowd. And who knows how long it took somebody to hear the men yelling from the locked in room.
Yeah. And also, I mean, were they wearing masks?
Yeah.
No one could identify.
Yeah, I think they were wearing
masks. No security cameras back then. Wow, that is a brazen.
Yeah. It was way easier to get away with robbery back then. They didn't know how easy they had it.
Did I tell you about my grandfather?
Mm-mm.
When he worked, he was an engineer, and he worked at a place. And he was actually really close with his boss, and he would help his boss out on payday. Like, everything was in cash or whatever. So he went in one day, and they got robbed. And the guy shot his boss. Boss dies and shot my grandfather, but he was okay. He was just shot in the shoulder.
Oh my God.
And like, yeah, I'm just like, what? I actually found the bullets that were in him. My mom still has them.
Oh my God.
That shit happened all the time. I think it made local news.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. At least they didn't shoot them.
Yeah.
I have to say, at least they had the decency to just shove them in the closet.
Exactly. Yeah. Just be like, oh, all we want is your money. Like, we don't actually want to
yeah.
have anybody. Yeah. Oh, that's crazy.
I wonder how much they were betting on the.
So they got away with over $20,000. And this is 1923. So
a whole lot.
The whole lot. Yeah, that was a very high stakes poker game. They did not.
In 1925, Louis Seelbach, president of the Seelbach Hotel Company, died. On April 1st, 1926, Chicago-based businessman Abraham M. Liebling bought the hotel for approximately $2.5 million. That's a lot of money for back then. It's rumored Liebling was friends with Al Capone, who stayed at the hotel a lot. That makes sense. And I'll tell you why I think it makes sense, other than the obvious, like, gangsters all know each other, is that in the gangster world, it almost was, oddly enough, a very inclusive space where the Italians, the Irish, and the Jews kind of all worked together or were enemies, but like they kind of ran the streets. And I'm surprised that I'm assuming this guy's Jewish, Liebling.
He was, but he wasn't a gangster. He was a banker.
Money. Right.
Yeah. I mean, he was probably Al Capone's banker. Like,
yeah.
They don't know, but very good chance.
For sure. It just, it's funny where these like little bursts of, what's the word? Progressive. during such a time, I think it's rare.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's very difficult, especially for that amount of money, and especially in the South.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing. I'm just saying it makes sense.
Yeah, I wonder what made Liebling want to buy the Seelbach, because like it says it, he was Chicago based.
The Kentucky Derby?
Maybe. Oh, yeah.
I bet you there's some,
lots of betting going on. The hotel formerly had a historic restaurant called the Oak Room, which was Kentucky's only AAA Five Diamond Restaurant Award winner, one of 44 in the nation. Ooh, so it was good. It was frequented by gangsters during Prohibition for card games, including Lucky Luciano, Dutch Schultz, and, of course, Al Capone. Capone sent a large mirror from Chicago, still in the Oak Room today, so that he could face the mirror during poker games. Either to watch his back or possibly so he could see his opponent's cards because he hated to lose. So
oh my God.
Such a cheater.
Not surprised.
I know. The Oak Room also has two hidden doors behind special panels that allowed Capone and the others to escape if the police tried to raid the game. They came out in the basement by the Rathskeller, where there were secret passageways leading to other buildings in the neighborhood.
That right there, first of all, awesome. Second of all, that's why his friend owns the hotel. This is, you know.
Yeah. I would not be surprised if there were some bootlegging happening through some of those tunnels as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet since the Rathskeller was probably too public to be a speakeasy, I bet the drinking happened in the Oak Room where... because there was like, oh, it also said there was at the main desk in the lobby, there was a button that could trip the secret panels. So that's how they would let them know, hey, the police are coming, is they would trip it from the lobby. And when they saw the doors opening, like the little thing open, they'd be like, oh, time to go.
Wow.
Or
you got to have connections there.
Yeah, they could at least hide what they were doing. They could get all their money and cards off the table and pretend like they're just... they're having tea or whatever, or if they felt the need, they could escape.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah,
I like that little, I wonder if it still exists.
Well, the Oak Room closed as a restaurant in 2018, but it was converted to a ballroom. So you can still see, I think they still have the mirror hanging in there and you can still see the panels and stuff.
Do you think the panels still work?
Oh, I bet they do. I bet that's got to be something that they do torture.
Yeah, they should.
I wonder if they let you still like slip out and like follow the path.
In 1929, Liebling sold the hotel to the Empley Hotel Company for $2 million. So at a loss.
Yeah.
But I guess he only sold it like 2 years later. So, or 3 years later. Empley Hotel Company sold the Seelbach along with his other properties to Sheraton Hotels in 1956 as a part of a $30 million deal. Wow. Okay, that's a gain. Go Sheraton. This made the Seelbach part of the second largest hotel sale in U.S. history at the time.
Really? I think Hilton had the first largest sale, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's impressive. The hotel became the Sheraton Seelbach Hotel, but its name was soon shortened to the Sheraton Hotel. Ew!
I know.
Sheraton sold the hotel along with 17 other aging properties to Gotham Hotels in 1968, and it regained its original name. Thank God. Following a severe national economic slump, the hotel closed in July 1975 after the owners went bankrupt. The damn 70s.
In 1978, Louisville native and television actor Roger Davis bought the Seelbach. Restoration began in early 1979 and a grand reopening was held on April 12, 1982. It was sold to Medallion Hotels in 1990, then to Capstar Hotels in 1998 when it became the Seelbach Hilton. The Blackstone Group purchased it in 2006, but sold it in 2007 to Interstate Hotels and Resorts and InvestCorp. It was renovated in 2009 for $12 million, then sold again in 2017 to Rockbridge Capital. And this is such now like the common thing, like hotels just get sold over and over and over again.
Yeah, it seems like they crash in the 70s and then have to be bought by 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm. And renovated over and over again for millions of dollars, like every 5 years, and then sold again.
Yeah. And I wonder why that is.
So the hotel has also been named to one of the Historic Hotels of America's Most Haunted Hotels list in the past because of their ghost story of the Lady in Blue. And this is apparently verified. Not the ghost part isn't verified, but the story itself is from a New York Times article. So this event historically did happen and is possibly the reason as to why people have seen this ghost. So in the winter of 1987, the chef at the Seelbach Hilton was preparing waffles and omelets for Sunday brunch. He looked out toward the number 3 elevator and saw a lady with long dark hair and a blue chiffon dress walk inside. This would be unremarkable, except that she walked through closed elevator doors. So obviously he was a little taken aback.
Yeah.
He reported what he observed to security immediately. And within minutes of his report, a housekeeper from the second floor reported seeing the very same lady. In both reports, the doors to the elevator were closed. So a possible answer to who this lady in blue is was found in a newspaper article from 1936. The story reports that a lady working at the Starks building came across the street to the Seelbach Hotel to meet her husband, who was killed in a car accident on the way to the hotel.
Oh, no.
And she was so upset that they're not sure by accident or on purpose, but she plunged to her death in the number 3 elevator shaft wearing a long blue chiffon dress.
Oh my God. So that really happened?
Yeah.
So creepy.
I know. So, aside from the lady in blue, the hotel is allegedly home to other spirits. The staff of the Auto Cafe reported seeing an older woman in ragged clothes peeking from behind the mirror. And when they turned to talk to her, she had disappeared. In 2004, a couple staying at the hotel booked a room on the 8th floor for their honeymoon, and they awoke to find a strange man standing by the window and looking out onto the city. The temperature in the room also dropped quickly after they saw him.
Oh my
And then other sightings include apparitions in hotel mirrors, disembodied voices, the faint scent of perfume. Okay, that one is silly. Like
that one's not interesting. Unexplained footsteps, not interesting either.
Yeah.
Disembodied voices. Voices are okay.
Yeah. It's so difficult when you're in a place like a hotel to really rely on things like disembodied voices, because you're literally surrounded on all sides by other people, and there's air shafts that people's voices could be coming from other rooms.
That's true. Yeah.
Like those are difficult. Apparitions in a mirror, that is freaky. Don't care for that.
I'm shocked. Elkbone's dead. Right? Yeah, no, I know.
Yes.
He's been around for too long. Where did he, wouldn't he haunt?
Would he haunt Alcatraz? Isn't that where he was imprisoned?
Wouldn't he haunt a place that he liked?
Yeah, as Michelle Heston said in our episode for the Claremonts, ghosts haunt where they're happiest. So maybe he would haunt the Sealbach where he's playing poker and having a good time.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, he's been in so many hotels. You think he would haunt somewhere in Vegas? Because he was in Vegas a lot, right? Like,
possibly. Yeah.
That would be cool. Okay, that would be a cool, like, ghost story. You're, like, in the hotel and you hear the little clinkly clackings of poker chips somewhere.
Yeah.
And then you hear a door open.
You smell cigar smoke.
Yeah.
And you're like, the clink of glasses.
The clink of glasses, poker chips, and then a door opening because he needs
the secret passage door opens. Oh, that would be great.
That's like, I'm down for that. I'm waiting for my ghost experience because I'm not a believer.
Yeah, it'll have to be a good one for you since you're such a skeptic.
I'm a skeptic. It doesn't mean I don't get freaked out. And when I was younger, like, I really believed in everything. But I was working at a spa in a hotel, and they also told me about ghost stories. And the spa, like, my coworker, everyone's like, the spa's haunted. And so one night I was with my coworker, and he's like, I don't want to go and check in that room. I think there's a ghost there. Like, and everyone thought there was a ghost. I'm like, all right, I'll do it. So I go. And nothing happened. It was just an empty room, but it was creepy. It still felt creepy because it was like dark. And I was like, just because they set this, like, there's a ghost. And I'm like, where's the ghost? I want to see the ghost. And because I wanted to see the ghost, maybe the ghost was like, that's not the point. This isn't fun if you want to see me. But yeah, I was disappointed. There was no ghost, but I felt a creepy vibe.
Yeah.
But that's not a ghost. That's just me being creeped out.
Vibe, yeah.
So I have a belief about ghosts. If they're, I don't think they're harmful. They're confused. They don't know even how to get into the place. They like almost repeat a scene in their memory, like going through the elevator. Like, they're not coming after you. It's just eerie. So if there are ghosts out there, I don't think it makes a difference. I don't think it would be like, I don't think it would profoundly change the way the world functions or what we believe.
Yeah, I think there's both. I think there's the confused ghosts that don't know where they are or don't know that they're gone. I think there's the ones who just want some acknowledgement, that they're just like, hey, I'm here too. Like, do you know I'm here? Just like any person wants a little attention. And then I think there are the ones who were assholes in life and are going to be assholes in death and but make people freak out.
Okay, yes. For sure. Like, there are the ones who want to freak out or be like, I died a terrible death and now I'm going to freak you out because
misery loves company and I'm traumatized. So you need to be traumatized too.
But I still don't think they're harmful other than you being freaked out. Like, I don't think they're going to kill you or hurt you physically harm you.
So unless they throw something at you, they could physically harm you.
Like, how much damage can they do?
I don't know. There's always those creepy ones of like where people like wake up with like arm like bruises and arm like finger marks on their body and stuff.
I've never heard of like a really dangerous ghost story. It's always like, I got tickled in the middle of the night. You know, like
I like the ones where it's like the ghost uncovers your feet while you're in bed.
Or like you saw a cat, you know, or so
Oh, I love the ghost animal ones.
Yeah, ghost animals, I'm so down. I would love more ghost animals.
Yes.
But I just think in general, I think a part of me is like, I'm scared of being in a dark room just because it's an instilled fear in me as a kid. But there's also comfort in knowing that they can't do much. Like, I don't feel like there's a final destination situation happening.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So I find comfort in ghosts. I don't think it's the worst thing. Maybe also I watched Casper too many times.
I hope all ghosts are as nice as Devon Sawa.
Yeah, and cute.
And cute. I think that's it. We are releasing a Kentucky Derby themed cocktail as well this weekend. So check that out on our Instagram and TikTok at Hotel History Podcast. And who are you going to be rooting for?
Chunk of Gold, as I mentioned.
Chunk of Gold. I love that name.
Tiztastic.
I keep forgetting about him.
Yeah. Those are the names that really popped out to me.
Yeah. I like that there was both a journalism and a publisher. So I feel like I have to root for both of them because they...
You need to have two.
Go together.
How much money are you betting?
I am going to bet negative $17.
I'm betting 3 cents.
I don't even know how to bet. I'm sure there's a website or something. I don't know.
This is just my make-believe bet.
Yeah, I don't...
I want to have the satisfaction of knowing I was right. What makes a good horse? What is a good predictor this horse is going to win? You have no idea.
Won the last one? I don't know.
But I feel like horses are very moody.
You have to look at their performance over time, I think. I don't think one race is a good indicator. You've got to see, do they come out of the gate strong? Do they have good endurance? Is their jockey able to see the various holes and places? Does he have good timing of when to put the horse's energy to full use?
Oh, so the jockey's just as important as the horse.
The jockey's very important.
Yeah, but what about your horse just is fuck it, I don't want to do it. I feel like that's the thing about horse.
That's true. The horse
can't
could
really
be moody.
Control them.
Yeah, they might not feel good that day. They might trip a little bit coming out. And if they trip at the starting gate, they're done.
Yeah.
What's the weather doing? Is it hot? Is it the track muddy? There's so many things that go into it. I feel so bad for the horses when they have to race on a muddy track. It makes me so anxious that one of them's going to get injured.
Is that how they get injured?
That's one of the ways. I mean, there's other ways. They could just pull a hamstring, they could.
Yeah.
Like any athlete, your muscles are.
Yeah, they must be. They have to be young and sprightly. Mm-hmm. When I went horseback riding that one time in my life, as an adult, I'm terrified. I love horses and I'm also terrified of them. I like to keep my distance.
Yeah.
But I was on my horse and the lady that was taking us to do a little trail tour, she was on her horse. And I'm like, how do you know if you're controlling your horse? I don't want it to gallop. Really didn't want my horse to gallop, and the other horse galloped, and then that one galloped. I'm like, you need to stop galloping. And she's like, oh, you have no idea. You can't control a horse. She basically was like, you're just communicating with the horse as best as you can, but the horse is its own thing. If it decides to do what it wants, you're just going.
You just got to go with the flow. The horse has its own attitude, its own mind. I mean, it definitely helps to ride a horse that you have a relationship with because then they are more likely to listen to you. I remember I went to ride horses with a friend of mine who she owned a couple of horses because she did horse shows and that kind of thing. And of course, her horse, her personal horse, whose name was Fancy, I think, was 2 or 3 years old. She rode her all the time, wanted to be ridden, great relationship with this horse. The horse she gave me to ride was 17 years old. This old nag that was get this kid off me. I don't want to be out here right now. I want she and so this horse would purposely run me into the fence, run me into the bush, run me into the tree branches that were hanging over the ring. And I was and like, she wouldn't do anything or go anywhere. She did not want me on her. So yeah, that was
I went on a horse one time before. I went on a horse three times in my life. Once I was like six, a pony ride in the farm. And then, so that what doesn't count. And then one time when I was like 16 at a summer camp I worked at, they let like teenagers run this horse thing. And they were like, yeah, get on the horse. And my horse started a fight with another horse. So I got the fuck off that horse. I was like, sir, my horse kicked another horse.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I'm like, because a 16-year-old was in charge.
Of course.
I was like, I need to get off this horse. And then my final time was on my birthday when I was like, I need to get over my fear of going on horses. But I was traumatized. I was like, I don't want to be involved in a horse fight.
Thanks for listening to Hotel History. You can follow us on most social media platforms, Patreon, and Substack by searching for Hotel History or Hotel History Podcast. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify so we can reach more listeners.